Right. Welcome back to the Deep Dive, everybody. Today we're going deep on a case that is really fundamental to administrative law.
Oh yeah,
United States v. Florida East Coast Railway Co.
This is a big one.
Yeah, this is a big one, and it's it's had a big impact, kind of setting the ground rules for how federal agencies actually create regulations, the rules that honestly touch all of our lives every day.
That's right. And for those of you listening, you know, you can really think of this case as helping us to understand a core power dynamic.
Yeah.
You know, it really defines when agencies, like the FDA or the Department of Homeland Security have to go through, you know, a much stricter, more demanding process versus when they have more flexibility to do things their way.
Right.
And so really, at its heart, we're talking about checks and balances in the administrative state. You know, are those checks and balances working? Are they being, subverted?
Yeah. So let's set the stage here. Take a little trip back in time to the 1960s.
Okay.
And picture this, right? There's a major, major problem on the railroads, like a literal log jam.
Uh-huh.
A shortage of freight cars. Like, everybody needs them. And the Interstate Commerce Commission, the ICC, right.
Yeah,
the regulatory body in charge at the time, they're looking at this and they say, all right, we got to do something about this.
Right.
So their solution, they come up with something called incentive per diem rates.
Yeah.
The idea was, you know, if you're a railroad and you just keep borrowing freight cars from other railroads and instead of buying your own, well, we're going to make that really expensive for you.
Right.
They wanted to incentivize the railroads to actually own their own cars.
You know, what I think is so interesting here is the way the ICC went about this, they essentially decided, hey, we're going to gather all the information and feedback that we need just through written comments.
Yeah.
Just have the railroads, you know, and other parties just write in and tell us what they think. But, you know, the railroads, they're looking at this. They're facing potentially some really big costs if these new rates go into effect. And they're like, hold on a second. We want the opportunity to have an actual, like, in-person hearing, you know?
Yeah.
We want to present our arguments, maybe even have a chance to question the data that the ICC is using to justify all this.
Right.
But the ICC basically just said, thanks, but no thanks. Written submissions are all we need.
And I'm sure the railroads weren't super happy with that response. You know, they felt like they weren't going to really get a fair shake, that their concerns wouldn't be fully understood or addressed without, a more formal back and forth process.
Right.
So what did they do?
Yeah.
They took the ICC to court. And this is where our deep dive really, really picks up steam.
Right.
The fundamental question is, what kind of hearing, if any, was the ICC legally obligated to provide in this situation?
Yeah, this is where we get to, the real crux of the legal fight.
Yeah.
So the railroads are arguing, look, the ICC, they have to hold formal hearings, the kind that are laid out in sections 556 and 557 of the Administrative Procedure Act, the APA.
Right. Yeah.
And those sections, you know, those are a big deal. They require a much stricter process, much more demanding on the agency. It includes things like the right to actually present your evidence orally, and really importantly, the ability to cross-examine witnesses.
Yeah.
You know, the railroads felt like without these safeguards, their right to due process was being totally undermined.
Right. But, you know, the ICC, they're pushing back. They're saying, no, we followed the right procedure. And in our view, you know, it was totally sufficient, which is this more informal notice and comment process under APA Section 553. So that's a much lighter process, right?
Yeah.
The agency publishes a proposed rule in the Federal Register, and then they give the public a chance to submit written feedback.
Right.
And that's pretty much it. So we've got this back and forth, and the legal wheels start turning.
They do.
The district court initially sides with the railroads.
Right.
They say, yeah, you know, the ICC, you should have given them a formal hearing. But this is not the end of the story.
No.
The Supreme Court steps in, and in a landmark decision, they reverse that lower court ruling.
Big time.
So this case lands on the Supreme Court's doorstep.
Right.
What are the big burning legal questions that they're wrestling with?
Well, there are two really core questions that the Supreme Court has to sort out. First, they got to interpret the Interstate Commerce Act itself, specifically Section 114.
Okay.
That section gave the ICC the authority to establish these per diem rates, but it said they could do so after hearing.
Right.
And the railroads were arguing, see that phrase right there, after hearing, that means a formal trial-like hearing. That's a testimine. So the court had to decide if that was a valid interpretation.
Okay, so the first hurdle is figuring out what Congress meant in that specific law.
Mm-hmm.
What was the second big legal question the Supreme Court had to address?
The second question, and I think this is the one that had, bigger ripple effects down the line, was whether the formal hearing requirements in those APA sections, 5566 and 557, whether those even applied to this specific kind of action that the ICC was taking.
Yeah.
And this really forced the court to think hard about, you know, the different types of actions that administrative agencies can take and the procedures that are supposed to go along with them.
Right.
You know, when do we need to bring out the full due process toolkit? When is it okay to have something a little less formal?
All right, so let's dive into Justice Rehnquist's majority opinion for the court.
Okay.
What were the main arguments that led him to conclude that the ICC's more informal approach was actually okay legally?
So Justice Rehnquist, he really grounded his reasoning in two key legal principles.
Huh.
The first was statutory interpretation. They looked very carefully at the language in the Interstate Commerce Act. You know, they really zeroed in on that phrase, after hearing. And what they decided was those words by themselves, they don't automatically mean that the ICC had to hold a full-blown formal hearing under the APA.
Right.
The key, the thing that was missing, was more specific language, particularly the phrase on the record.
Mm.
So the court was basically saying, look, if Congress really wants an agency to be bound by those strict formal hearing procedures, they need to say so clearly and directly in the statute.
So it wasn't enough for the law to just say there has to be a hearing. They had to use those specific magic words, on the record.
Right.
That seems like a really crucial detail.
It is. It's incredibly important. So the court drew this bright line after hearing. That's a more general term.
Yeah.
It could be satisfied by different ways of getting information, including, you know, written submissions.
Right.
But on the record, that has a very specific legal meaning in the world of the APA. That's the trigger. That's what sets off those formal procedures we see in sections 556 and 557, including that right to cross-examination.
Okay, so I get the importance of that specific legal terminology.
Huh.
What was the second big part of Justice Rehnquist's argument?
The second key piece of the court's reasoning was the distinction they made between what they called legislative and adjudicative rulemaking.
Okay.
So they decided that what the ICC was doing here, setting these per diem rates for the whole industry, that was fundamentally an act of legislative rulemaking.
Okay.
And this kind of rulemaking, it's about creating those big, broad policy rules that apply to a whole sector or to a general class of parties. You know, think of it like making a law that applies to everyone in a certain industry.
And how is that different from adjudication in the court's eyes?
So adjudication, that's more like a court proceeding. It's about resolving specific disputes between specific parties, often about things that happened in the past. You know, imagine an agency holding a hearing to figure out if a specific company broke a particular safety rule. That process would probably involve what we call adjudicative facts.
Okay.
Specific details about what that company did, the evidence, the witnesses, all that.
So if I'm following you, rulemaking is setting those general rules for the future, applies broadly. Adjudication is looking back at specific actions and making decisions about individual parties.
Exactly. And to kind of nail down this distinction even further, the court actually referenced an earlier case, a big one, ICC v. Louisville and Nashville ARCO.
Okay.
And that case really helped to solidify this idea that agencies have these different functions and the procedures should fit the function.
Gotcha. And this distinction between legislative and adjudicative rulemaking, that's connected to the types of facts the agency's dealing with, right?
That's right. So in this Florida East Coast Railway case, the ICC, they were mainly working with what we call legislative facts.
Cool.
Those are the big picture facts, general facts about policy issues and industry-wide conditions. Things like the overall shortage of freight cars, the economic effects of different rate structures, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And that's different from adjudicative facts, which we talked about, those specific facts about the parties involved in a dispute, who did what, when, where, and why in a specific instance. So think of legislative facts more like economic data and policy arguments. Adjudicative facts are more like the evidence you'd see in a trial.
Okay. So the court's reasoning was, since the ICC was dealing with those big policy questions, those industry-wide data, the legislative facts, rather than those specific disputes between, individual railroads, specific adjudicative facts, the more informal process of just gathering written comments, that was enough.
That was their conclusion. They said, look, when an agency is making these big policy calls based on legislative facts, getting a bunch of written perspectives from different people, that can be a really efficient way to get the info they need to think about different viewpoints.
Yeah.
They emphasize that the APA, you know, it's meant to give agencies some flexibility in choosing their procedures, unless Congress specifically says they have to do something more formal. And the key here was, Congress hadn't specifically said that the ICC needed to hold formal hearings for this kind of broad, industry-wide rate setting.
Now, of course, we know this wasn't a unanimous decision from the Supreme Court. Justice Douglas wrote a dissent. What was his take on the whole situation?
Yeah, Justice Douglas, he saw things pretty differently. He argued that, yeah, the ICC's decision to put these per diem rates in place, it did have a broad application, but it was basically quasi-adjudicatory. He was really focused on the fact that these rates were going to have a direct and a big financial impact on individual railroads. And for him, that direct economic impact that kind of muddied the waters, blurred the lines that the majority was trying to draw between legislative rulemaking and adjudication.
So he felt like because the railroad's financial well-being was being so directly affected, they deserved more procedural protection than just having to send in written comments.
Exactly. He was really worried that by denying the railroads that chance to have an oral hearing, and especially the ability to cross-examine the data and the reasoning behind the ICC's proposed rates, the agency was potentially violating their due process rights. He pointed out that the railroads had raised specific concerns. They were even questioning the accuracy of the data that the ICC was relying on.
Yeah.
And without that chance to directly question that info through cross-examination, he felt like the railroads were at a big disadvantage.
So it sounds like he saw this as a situation where the agency had a lot of power, and without the right procedural checks and balances, there was a real risk of decisions being made that were unfair or just not based on good information.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. His dissent can be read as a kind of warning, a cautionary tale, you know, about what can happen when agencies have a ton of authority, but maybe they're not being held accountable procedurally in the right ways.
Okay. And how did the majority opinion try to address those concerns that Justice Douglas was raising?
So Justice Rehnquist and the majority, they stuck to their guns. They said, look, the ICC's rule, it was general. It was meant to apply going forward to the whole railroad industry. It wasn't singling out specific railroads for things they did in the past. It wasn't trying to resolve a specific one-off dispute. And because of that broad future-oriented nature of what they were doing, they said those less formal notice and comment procedures were good enough.
So the heart of the disagreement seems to be how they categorized the agency's action. Was it a broad policy decision affecting the whole industry? Or was it something that, while it was generally applicable, had such a direct and big impact on individual companies that it should have triggered those stronger procedural protections?
Exactly. And the majority's view, that's what won out. That's right. What became the legal precedent. But Justice Douglas's dissent, it raises some really important questions that are still relevant today. Questions about fairness, due process, for the people and companies that are being regulated. It's a tension that still gets debated a lot in administrative law.
Yeah. So this case seems to have really laid down some key principles that affect how agencies operate today. Hmm. What are the big takeaways from Florida East Coast Railway? Why is it still such an important case in administrative law?
Well, it's definitely a landmark case. It made this really clear and influential distinction about the procedural requirements for different kinds of agency actions. It basically cemented this idea that formal trial-like hearings under the APA, sections 556 and 557, those are only required when Congress specifically says on the record in the law that gives the agency its power. If the law uses a more general term, like after hearing, like we saw with the Interstate Commerce Act, then usually those more relaxed notice and comment procedures from Section 553 are good enough.
So it really does all come down to that specific wording in the law.
Absolutely. That phrase on the record, that's like the magic key that unlocks those more formal requirements.
Yeah.
And without it, agencies generally have more flexibility to do things in a less formal way. And this has huge implications for how efficiently the whole administrative state can function.
So what are the bigger implications of that? You know, it sounds like it gives agencies a lot of leeway, but is there a downside for the folks being regulated?
Yeah, that's a really good point. This ruling definitely gives agencies more flexibility. They can move faster, be more efficient, especially when they're dealing with these big picture policy issues that affect a whole industry or a big chunk of the public.
Right.
But like Justice Douglas pointed out in his dissent, sometimes that flexibility can come at the expense of procedural fairness for those who are directly impacted by the agency's rules.
Right.
They might not get those same strong chances to challenge the evidence directly, to present their case in person, to cross-examine opposing views like they would in a more formal setting. And that raises concerns about fairness and accountability.
You mentioned earlier a sort of two-part test that comes out of this case. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, so the court didn't lay out a numbered test, you know, step one, step two, but we can kind of look at their reasoning and see a two-pronged inquiry that's really helpful for figuring out how formal the procedures need to be.
Okay.
The first prong is, does the specific law that governs what the agency is doing, does it specifically require an on-the-record hearing? If the answer is no, then the second question is the agency trying to resolve disputed adjudicative facts, those specific facts about particular individuals or companies? So in the Florida East Coast Railway case, the court said neither of those conditions were met. The Interstate Commerce Act, it didn't say on the record hearing, and the ICC was mainly dealing with those big picture legislative facts about industry policy. They weren't trying to settle specific factual arguments between particular railroads.
In that framework, that has had a lasting impact on how agencies work today, right?
Oh, absolutely. Florida East Coast Railway, it's like a cornerstone. It explains why so many agencies today rely on that informal rulemaking process from Section 553. For a ton of agencies, you know, from the EPA setting pollution standards to the FTC making rules about unfair business practices, the notice and comment process, that's their bread and butter.
Right.
It lets them get input from lots of different people without all the heavy lifting and time that comes with those formal hearings. And that's been crucial for how we do regulation in the modern world.
Now, you said there were a couple of important nuances about this case that we should make sure to highlight. What were those?
Right. One really important thing to keep in mind is that the Supreme Court in Florida East Coast Railway, they were focused very narrowly on the procedural part of rulemaking.
Okay.
They didn't say anything about whether those per diem rates that the ICC came up with, whether those were actually good policy. They didn't decide if the ICC had enough evidence to back them up. The case was actually sent back down to the lower courts for them to look at those substantive issues that the railroads were raising. So the Supreme Court was only looking at how the rule was made, not what the rule actually said.
Okay, so they were just looking at the process, not the substance.
Exactly. And the other important nuance, and this goes back to Justice Douglas's dissent, was his worry that agencies might try to take shortcuts, you know, procedural shortcuts, like just relying on written comments to avoid tougher scrutiny from the public and challenges to the rules they're proposing, especially when those rules could have a big financial impact on the businesses or people being regulated. So it's a good reminder that while efficiency is important, you got to balance that against transparency, accountability, and making sure that people who are affected by government actions have a real chance to be heard.
So for our listeners out there who are wading into the sometimes murky waters of administrative law, what's the big lesson, the core takeaway from our deep dive into United States v. Florida East Coast Railway Co.?
I'd say the most important lesson is to really pay close attention to the specific words in the law that gives an agency its power to make rules.
Okay.
Look carefully for that phrase on the record.
Right.
And also think about what the agency is doing. Are they making broad policy for a lot of people, that legislative rulemaking? Or are they trying to resolve a specific fight between specific parties, that's adjudication?
Yeah.
This case gives us a really useful framework for understanding those different levels of formality that are required under the APA and why those distinctions are so important for how the whole administrative state works.
And it really highlights that fundamental tension that's built into administrative law, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, the need for the government to work efficiently, effectively, but at the same time, we have to protect people's due process rights, make sure things are fair, especially when there's a lot at stake, financially or otherwise.
Absolutely. It makes you think hard about whether that balance is always being struck in the right way.
Well, this has been a really illuminating deep dive into United States v. Florida East Coast Railway Co. Thanks so much for helping us understand this really important case.
My pleasure.
And to all of you listening, thanks for joining us on the deep dive. We'll be back next time with another exploration into the cases and concepts that shape our legal world.
See you then.